elementary question about it. Not elementary in the sense that it's simple, but it's the most fundamental. Sefer Dvarim, we would have thought, is whose book? I mean, like, who authored it, anyway, you would think, is Moshe. So then how did it get into the Torah? It really should, by all rights, be the first of the books of the Nevi'im. Meaning, the way that I always like to picture is what we should have had is four books, right, of the Torah, and then Nevi'im. So it would have been really great if the first of the books of the Nevi'im was from the greatest Navi of all time, Moshe. So then you could have had Moshe, the book of Moshe, what we call Sefer Dvarim, Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim, etc., etc., through the Nevi'im Achronim. So the fact that it's not should be very surprising to us. Of course, we live in a post Chamisha Chumshe Torah world, so, you know, we're all regulated to that, but the if you take a step back and you think about it, that's a little funny, because if Moshe, right, the first pasuk says that Moshe was Eilu HaDvarim Asher Dibra Moshe Al Kol Yisrael, that Moshe said all these things. Okay, this is the last 37 days or so of Moshe's life. We know that Sefer Dvarim begins on the first day of the 11th month. Moshe dies on the 7th day of the 12th month. So that's the rabbinic tradition that he died on Zayin Adar, which was the day that he was born. So in any event, you're talking about a month and change, 5 weeks. So if Moshe is really the author, that's what the indication is, so then why would this even be included in a Chamisha Chumshe Torah? That raises a lot of questions for us. Because how could it be that something, meaning as great as Moshe was, the Torah has to be, you know, direct divine revelation, not even Moshe's own.
Well, that's been questions been asked, nobody's really answered it satisfactorily.
But wasn't many yeah. of the things, the revelation was from Hashem to Moshe.
Yeah.
And he recorded what Hashem said to him.
Yeah.
And there's those that say that the last words were actually written by Moshe by his tears.
Yeah, so that's what Arthur is saying is a machlokas in the Gemara of Baba Basra, that whatever you say about Sefer Dvarim writ large, then you still have an additional question about the last eight psukim from Vayamot Moshe Eved Hashem, because that obviously presents a whole different set of challenges. So there you have multiple opinions in that Gemara. But what's, you know, it's really interesting is that, you know, here you have Arthur and Susan both mentioning it, the idea that, okay, well, the rest of the Torah was communicated by Hashem to Moshe, but in a very different way, right? That was Hashem sort of dictating to Moshe, you know, his own words, and Moshe writing them down or teaching them and then writing them down, however you, whatever scheme one subscribes to. But the point really is those were Hashem's words. But here, it's really, to a certain extent, or at least to a greater extent, Moshe's own. So how does that warrant being included in the first four books? That's really a crucial question. That could challenge sort of the status of Sefer Dvarim as a whole. And we have to at least ask that question. So the Bravanel really is the one who deals with these questions in the greatest amount of depth, and we're going to get to his position. But let me just lay out that question to begin with. Number two is, what's the nickname for Sefer Dvarim? This is a related point, but it's somewhat distinct. What's Mishnah Torah? So what does that even mean?
Second or repetition.
Okay, so repetition of Torah. So very good. So the Tosfos in Maseches Gittin sort of interprets it as follows. Chozer al mashakasiv l'mala, a repetition of that which came before. Okay, so if that's the way you want to interpret Mishnah Torah, then you've got like a whole series of problems. What's the most basic problem that, if you interpret that way?
There's some additional mitzvah.
Yeah, right. Very good, Alan. So then you're kind of stuck because there's all these new things, and like pretty important new things. You know, you have the mitzvah of marriage and divorce and yibum. And the mitzvah, if it's certainly the way the Rambam reads it, if you believe there's a mitzvah of having a king, that only comes up in Sefer Dvarim. So like major, major things are coming up for the first time. It doesn't seem really accurate to describe it as a repetition. Not only that, but even the things which have been described before are being described very differently. You would hardly call that Chozer al Mashakas of Amala. Just to give one example, right, if you read the story of the Meraglim as it appears in Parsha Shlach, this is the famous example, but there are many others, right? You get a very different picture than if you just read Dvarim. And, you know, the interaction between the two is fascinating. So, that would be the second problem. Then the third problem with that would be, well, what do you mean chozer al mashakasav lamala? Like major, major, major things are missing. So number one, things are added. Number two, the things which are repeated aren't really repeated that they were the way they were before. And number three is a lot of things that aren't repeated. Both stories and halachos. So it's sort of hard to interpret Mishneh Torah that way. The Tosfos does. What would another possibility be for Mishneh Torah? Like, if it doesn't mean a repetition, then what might it mean?
Well, it's Moshe's repetition, so he doesn't have to.
Okay,
remember, I won't say Moshe forgot something. That might be heretical.
No. Well, we left that as a question
okay,
for now.
But it could be just that for whatever the reason was, he just chose not to say something, and perhaps there were some things that were, we would say, would otherwise have been part of the oral tradition that Moshe wrote.
Right. So,
or actually said, because it really says, this is what he said.
Correct.
Well, he didn't really write, said.
Okay, so that's actually really important. And what Susan is saying now is going to be sort of the crux of the Abravanel's answer to Alan's question. That's really important, the distinction between said and wrote. So let's just hang on to that for like 35 minutes and we're going to come back. Yeah, sure.
Like, kind of like these are the highlights and like clip notes.
Yeah.
Like if someone doesn't necessarily have time to go through all the details, you know, it's going to give you like flashes of what you can expect. It might not be exactly the same, but it's sort of like when you skip ahead to the last chapters and you sort of can get sort of a glimpse of what came before.
Okay, so very good. So what Alan here is suggesting are that it's a repetition, but the way that you skirt all the real problems that I raised with interpreting it that way is you say, well, it's a repetition with a kind of agenda. You know, it's a type of a repetition. It's not a comprehensive repetition, but it's a focused repetition or it's a guided repetition. And then you sort of have to figure out, well, what is the agenda? What's the organizing principle? Because everything in Dvarim is happening out of order in a very different kind of way. So that would be the way to, like, at least schematically, I think that's probably the best way to think about it. But are there any other radically different interpretations of Mishneh Torah? In other words, might it mean something different altogether than a repetition? I see Brian making a...
Various other words, the Mishnah.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's make it simple. We know what Torah means. What are the possible meanings of the term Mishnah?
Mishnah, to change.
Okay, good. So from the language of Shinui, that's one. We have like a lot of Mishnahs on the wall. What does it mean there? It doesn't necessarily mean a repetition. It means a teaching of the Torah. So in fact, there are Rishonim who say, no, Mishneh Torah, it's everybody just got confused. It doesn't mean a repetition. It's not a repetition. Just read it. It's not at all repetition. It's, in fact, a certain teaching of the Torah. But then you have to figure out, well, which aspects are being taught and which aspects are not being taught. So we're going to explore two different varieties of that school. One is the Abravanel, one is the Netziv, who take the position that Mishneh Torah really means a teaching of the Torah, or Mishnah from the language of Vishinantem, a Shinun HaTorah, a sharpening of the Torah. That's exactly what the Netziv says, and we're going to come back to that. But the point that I'm just trying to raise a little bit of consciousness of how there are like major disagreements here about what the purpose of Sefer Dvarim is. You know, based on how you interpret Mishneh Torah and how you address this very fundamental question, like, if this is really what Moshe said, Ela HaDvarim Asher Diber Moshe Kol Yisrael, I mean, as great as Moshe's speeches were, it doesn't really warrant inclusion in eternal Torah. The only thing which deserves to be in the... That should be in the Nevi'im. It would be great to be in the Nevi'im, but to be included in the Torah, it's probably got to be a little bit more than that. So how does one square that with Eilat Dvar Mishra Dibur Moshe? Yeah, Alan.
One thing is that, to a large extent, perhaps, the audience has changed.
Okay.
You had, you know, the generation of the Exodus at first that was experiencing, you know, very much of what's in the, not the first book, but the books 2, 3, and 4.
Right.
And, you know, but presume, and they had sort of heard book 1. Now, book 5 here doesn't really tell you what's in Reishi. So it's sort of picking up with the stuff that the generation of the Exodus would have perhaps seen themselves and, right. and teaching these new people, their descendants, this stuff.
So I think Alan's answer puts us in a better position and a worse position all at once. In other words, what I think it helps us with dramatically is the question of why would it be that Moshe, if you take the approach that he's repeating, so then you need a motivation, like what's the point? So then Alan sort of gets you there, which is, well, he kind of needed to because there's a change in audience. The people that originally heard this stuff are gone, so it's kind of repetition for Moshe, but it's not really repetition for them. It's their first time, his second time. Good enough, so that really helps. Same time, though, then we're worse off. Why? Because then you really need it to be a repetition of the whole thing.
It's not.
It's not.
It's more of a recapping of the important, the salient points.
Correct. And then once you're back there, I agree with Arthur. I think that's very accurate. Once you're back there, now you got a real problem. Because how can it be that, you know, Moshe is saying, okay, these are the Torah was kind of really big, but let me tell you the most important parts.
Well, it's all
that seems really audacious.
It's all going to be written, so, you know, you've seen the movie, now read the book.
Right. So then why these things? So there are a lot of basic questions here which need to be answered, and we haven't yet dealt with maybe the dominant approach within Chazal and the Rishonim about Sefer Dvarim, which is that what's the nature of the book? It is Eila HaDvarim. That's a code for?
It's a
speech. What kind of speech is it? A harangue. Okay. So Eila HaDvarim, Rashi explains, this is the first source. Eila HaDvarim, Lefi Shehein, Divrei is the critical term. Divrei Tochachos. Okay? So that this isn't an attempt to recapitulate or to review or anything else. What's really being done here is this is Moshe, you know, saying that I'm not going to be around too much longer, so let me try to literally put the fear of the Lord into you. That's what Sefer Dvarim is. And there's a whole wonderful tradition of Mamari Chazal, which really speak to this point, about how Sefer Dvarim is meant to be interpreted as Divrei Tochachos. So just take a look at, I just brought my two favorite examples, but you should just interpret this as representative of a massive corpus of material which points in the direction that Sefer Dvarim is really Divrei Tochachos. So this comes from the Dvarim Rabbah, the second source, Eila HaDvarim, Amar of Achab Rabbi Chanina, Reuyos Hayu HaTochachos Lomar Mipi Bilam, VeHabrachos Mipi Moshe. Okay. Chazal are pointing out it's a little bit funny because, you know, just before Sefer Dvarim, and not too much before, you have Bilam, and Bilam ended up giving the Jewish people wonderful brachos. Mm-hmm. And now Moshe and Bilam are always compared and contrasted, right? There are all these Mamari Chazal about Bilam sort of being the only Navi who was within Moshe's realm, except he was sort of, what was the guy with the Superman's like alter ego who was like Superman but evil?
Bizarro.
Yeah, Bizarro? Yeah, so Bilam is kind of like Bizarro. He's like Moshe's sort of empirical equivalent, but evil. And so Bilam and Moshe are always being, you know, compared and contrasted by Chazal. Point is that if I were to tell you tabula rasa, you have to guess which one is the one who said the brachos and which one is the one who said the klalos, you know, or who's the one who said tochacha, who criticized the Jewish people, who's the one that blessed the Jewish people. So we all would have said, okay, yeah, Moshe for sure will be the one who said good things about the Jewish people, and Bilam, who hated the Jewish people, will be the one to say...
Bilam, those words were put in his mouth.
Very, very, very true, but just the way that it worked out. Chazal are just pointing out this in a poetic sense. Of course that's true, Susan. That, there's no question about that. Chazal are not denying that. All they're pointing out is that they're just in a poetic way saying, well, isn't it funny that the last thing that Moshe did was rebuke the Jewish people? So they want to try to understand that. I mean, is that really how you want to sort of wrap things up?
Well,
ending on a downer.
Yeah, if you knew these people, that's how you would probably want to wrap them up.
Yeah, maybe.
They're not a good group of people.
Mm-hmm. Be careful about the good things that your enemies say. Pay attention to the harsh things that your friends say.
Okay, good. So Chazal says something pretty similar to that in the end, Alan. So he says, Ela ilu toch. Ila hochicham Bilam. If Bilam was the one who offered tochacha, hayu Yisrael omrim, the Jewish people would have said, "Sone mochichenu." Right? They would have asked rhetorically, "What? This guy who hates us is criticizing us." In other words, they would have disregarded it. V'ilu bracha Moshe, if Moshe was the source of their blessing, hayu umo sa'olam omrim, right, everybody else would have said, oh, Havan Birchan, right there. The of course, you know, what is this? Moshe, of course he's blessing the Jewish people. He's one of them. It's meaningless. So Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu Yochichan Moshe, let Moshe be their source of Tochacha, She'ohavan, okay, because Moshe, in fact, truly loves the Jewish people, and therefore his Tochacha is worth much more. I want to come back to that in just a moment. V'yivarchim Bilam She'sonam Kedei She'yizbaru HaBrachos VeTochachos B'yad Yisrael. Okay, so in other words, that there shouldn't be any kind of discounting of Bilam's contribution or of Moshe's. Point is that Chazal are putting their finger on a bit of this tension here, that Moshe really did love the Jewish people after everything he had been through. All the crises that he had to manage, Moshe really was an Ohev Yisrael. And yet, what it meant at this stage was that he had to offer them Tochacha. And they're putting their finger on that tension. And this was, in a certain sense, the last challenge that Moshe had to face. It was an internal challenge of sorts. The next Mamar Chazal points this out very strongly. When God said to Moshe that, you know, the end was coming, and Moshe realized that it was his responsibility to offer rebuke the Jewish people, he said, you know, no thanks. I'll leave that one to my successor. Because last time I tried this, or last time I used words of Tochacha, it didn't end well for me. What was the last time Moshe offered words of Tochacha? At Mei Meriva, which we studied together. And he said, Shimuna Hamorim, listen, you rebellious ones. And of course, that was his undoing. That was, Moshe was severely punished for that. So now I'm supposed to offer more Tochacha? So Chazal say the following mashal. This is God's answer. He says, okay, you know what this is like? You have a father and a son that are walking along the road, or teacher and student, doesn't matter. And the kid, the student, sees what he thinks is a precious jewel, something glowing. And he picks it up, and it's a coal, it's a burning coal, he gets burned very badly. Okay. Time goes by, they're walking again, and he sees something glowing. So he goes, oh, for sure, that's a burning coal, I better stay away. And his father says, look a little closer, that's actually a diamond, it's a jewel. And Hashem said, that's what's happening here. In other words, the first time you thought it was the right opportunity, but it was absolutely the wrong thing to do. But now, don't be fighting yesterday's battles, so don't be reliving yesterday. Now is actually the perfect moment, it's the most opportune time for you to offer Divrei Tochacha. This is what they need to hear right now. So Tochacha, Chazal are pointing out, is complicated. Gemara in Erechin says famously that the various Tanaim and Amoraim were discussing the mitzvah of Hocheach Tochiach Samisacha. There's a mitzvah Daraisa, you're supposed to remonstrate with your fellow Jew. And the Gemara says, you know, the truth is that there's really nobody who's very good at accepting this kind of critique. And the Gemara says, yeah, and there's nobody who really knows how to offer this critique either. So, Kishem Shemitzvah Lomar Adavar Hanishma, just like there's a mitzvah of giving Tochacha where it's appropriate, Kach Mitzvah Shalolon Mar Adavar Sheino Nishma, you know, it's equally important to know when to keep your mouth shut, which is common sense, but it's also, yeah, for those who are not into common sense, it's also Gemara, so get it from either place. Yeah, you have to know when to say when. And the point is that Tochacha is always complicated, and Moshe had a lot of ambivalence about this, but there was something very opportune about the moment. Now, what made this an opportune moment? This is a little morbid, but it's just the truth. It was that Moshe was dying. And Chazal, and this is quoted by Rashi, say, oh, you know, Moshe in this respect was following Yaakov. He's Yaakov Avinu, before he dies, calls in his sons, and it's supposed to be a big bracha, but if you read it, it's like not really, at least for Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, it's not even close to a bracha. So that just passes the buck one stage further, and here I just wanted to open it up. But what is it about imminent death that makes it a good time for Tochacha? Let me just put the question in even sharper terms. I would say, well, if this is your last chance, you might as well kind of get it end on a positive note. You know, so what is it about death and Tochacha that make them such good?
Well, it's like...
Sure, and then Susan, yeah.
I think it's like out of Ahava. I mean, he's like, he really is seeing Bnei Israel as his children, and I want to teach you all the mistakes I sort of made or that can be made so that you don't, that you have an easier life. I want your life to be easier rather than harder. So it's like a, in some ways I think it's easier to give a bracha and you'll get, you know, positive feedback. It's a much scarier thing to say, I really am saying this out of deep love for you, I care about you, and I want you to succeed with Hashem, you know, in your life future with Hashem.
Okay, this is really, really crucial, and I wanna come back to that. But just Susan, you had a comment also.
No, I think it's,
that's really, really good.
What I think, just the opposite. I think it's not like your vidui, but it is like a, you know, confession. You people have done the wrong thing, and I want to get this off my chest now, and I want to tell you that you've done the wrong thing because it's like something that I have to do. And I have to do it now before I die.
Okay, so this is really interesting. The point Shira and Susan are debating is really, it really deals with the question of how a person is dying. And I'm going to make a certain assumption that will lead me to take Shira's position. But I think it hinges. I think it really, what it really hinges on is a person willing to let go of their anger. So if a person is, you know, still basically really annoyed about things that went wrong, they might say, well, this is my last opportunity to really get it off my chest and then, you know, vent. And I'm assuming, and that's always possible, so that could make the moment before death sort of the last opportunity to really offer biting, penetrating, brutal tochacha. But I always make the assumption in this case, not sure if it's correct, but it is an assumption that Shira was making as well, that Moshe had let go of any of that, that there was a deep acceptance here of the reality of his imminent death. In which case, then I think the following point emerges. Namely, problem with tochacha under general circumstances is that a person is always suspect of having some kind of personal axe to grind. In other words, you're angry with me, and this is why you're being so critical. But if a person is dying, and not just they're dying, but they really come to deep terms with their death. They've accepted the idea that they're dying. So then those things are very small. They're petty. They fade in terms of the significance. So somebody, right, if you're really leaving this world and somebody wronged you in some monetary way, or somebody, right, wronged you in some kind of question of prestige, these things are small because the world is not going to exist anymore in the same respect for you. So who cares what anybody... So then, if you're still offering tochacha at that point, so then you've controlled for the personal factor. There's no longer any sense of a personal agenda, and it's purely principle-based or commitment to the future-based. And that's sort of the way that I see it. That's why I take Shira's position. Of course, I'm assuming that was Moshe's attitude. I do assume that. But I think that that's correct. In which case, what emerges is that I think what Chazal have in mind is that pre-death is always a good time for tochacha because you take you out of the picture, and what you and that's really hard to do at any other point, because if it's just a normal point in life and you go up to somebody and you criticize them, I'm not saying anybody should, but we're one to criticize somebody for not being observant enough, this or that, there's always an aspect of superiority and the sense of combativeness which is inherent in that. Is this person really doing it because they care so much about the mitzvah? Or is this person doing it because they sense an opportunity to feel good about themselves by putting somebody else down? I think that's why Chazal are pretty much really ambivalent about tochacha, unless it's coming from somebody who's very righteous and really isn't coming from a personal place. So, point is that the way that you control for that is when you negate the personal agenda of the remonstrator. And death is a really good way to do that. Okay, so that's the first approach to Sefer Dvarim, is that it's divrei tochachos which are enabled by Moshe's impending death. That's why Moshe has to do it now. This is why now is a good time. And that's why the Jewish people are receptive, because it's not about Moshe with a sense of superiority, Moshe lording himself over them. It's really simply about Moshe's commitment to the spiritual well-being, the ongoing spiritual well-being of the Jewish people. Okay. Any questions on that before we take a look at the Ramban? Yeah, Arthur, please.
Your feeling that I get from you is that there's a certain amount of anger in a person and telling people what they think. I think on the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a person is dying, he doesn't have to face these people afterwards. Often you couch words because you have to deal with people. And you would like to say a lot of things, but you have to continue the relationship.
This is very good.
Whereas, if, like he's dying, he can say it the way it is. He doesn't have to be burdened with them anymore. I mean, he can let it all come out.
You know, it's really interesting. I don't think it's mutually exclusive with the different approaches that we're suggesting. I think they could all be true, but I very much value what Arthur is saying. What Arthur is saying just now is really that Moshe's impending death allows him to say things that he may not have been able to say before. And not just in the case of Moshe, this could be true more broadly. You know, just to quote from the language of Chazal, going back to the first example that I mentioned, which was Yaakov. Anybody remember what it says? Why Yaakov only gave tochacha towards the end of his life? Yaakov says to Reuven, you know, I've had all these things to say to you for so long, but I'm only telling you now because I was always afraid. I was afraid that if I would say it earlier, you would leave me and go team up with Esav. The question is, what does that really mean? What are Chazal driving at? There are different ways of interpreting that medrash, but the way that Arthur would interpret it in light of his insight just now is that Yaakov felt that what he had to say in truth was so biting that it could have turned Reuven away entirely, and that he had to wait till, you know, Esav wasn't in the picture any longer, which by this point in Yaakov's life, Esav himself, I guess, was getting old, and that now Yaakov's impending death would allow him to say something that he couldn't say before. There are other ways of interpreting that medrash, but I think Arthur raises a very valid point, which is a whole different perspective on why tochacha and death could come together. Okay, so just to take the Ramban as a very classical piece. In general, something good to be aware of, that anytime you're starting a new Sefer of Chumash, it's always kedai, really is always worthwhile to take a look at the Ramban's introductions. They're really seminal. And the Ramban here is struggling with the question that we raised, the question of Mishneh Torah. So let's just take a look at a few paragraphs from the Ramban's introduction to Sefer Dvarim. HaSefer says, this is the fourth source, rather.
Well, the fourth, but it says fourth.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like...
He doesn't believe in four.
Yeah, and then what did I do after this? Okay, it just... There's an invisible fourth source. If you have 3D glasses, it comes up.
Like there's no 13
holograms. It's like whatever you call that. Hasefer Hazeh Yano Yadua Shuhu Torah. This sefer, it's known as the Mishneh Torah. Yevayer bo Moshe Rabbeinu l'dor hanichnas ba'aretz rov mitzvos haTorah hatzrichos liYisrael. So Moshe Rabbeinu is going to explain to the Jewish people. You notice the Ramban does not say all, because it wouldn't be accurate to say all, but the majority of the mitzvos haTorah, which are of course essential for the Jewish people. Velo yazkir bo davar b'toras kohanim velo b'masah korbanos velo b'taras kohanim b'masah shekvar biro sam lahem v'kohanim zrisahim lo yitzterchul azhara achar azhara aval b'Yisrael yachzor ha-mitzvos anogos b'hem pam lahosif b'hem biur upam shelo yachzor sam rak lahazir is Yisrael b'rov hazharos kemo sheyavou b'zefer hazeb b'nyanei avados gilulim azharos merubos v'achazo b'tochachos v'kol pachadim asher yachir osam. So the Ramban starts off by making this really interesting distinction. He says, you know, if you read Sefer Dvarim carefully, you'll notice that like a major portion of the Torah is left out. Anything to do with Korbanos and Tumah and Tara. So why isn't that mentioned? Especially if it's Mishneh Torah. Especially if you start with the premise that it should be a comprehensive review. So Ramban says, well, Moshe sort of knew his audience. So who's going to be primarily responsible for the Korbanos and Tara? The Kohanim. And they don't really need another review. Kohanim's Zrizimhem, to use the rabbinic expression. The Kohanim are, you know, very diligent. They act with alacrity. They don't need another review. But the rest of the Jewish people, you know, you can't review enough. And in particular, the focus is on Avodah Zarah. That's like the focus, and that would probably for two reasons, because it's objectively the most important. Like the most important thing a Jew can do is to be a monotheist. But beyond that, it was obviously of at most risk. All the other nations, where you're not going to find a lot of, you know, monotheistic people living in Canaan when the Jews were coming around. Okay, so that's a point that the Ramban is making. Okay. But now the Ramban, of course, is faced with the intractable dilemma. If the Ramban is taking the position that it's a review, and he can explain why it's not a comprehensive review, because he'll say the Korbanos and Tahara are missing because those people don't really need a review, but you still have the problem of the new material. The new material is totally unexplained. It's not a review if there's new material. You know, as we always used to say in elementary school, we had a teacher who always left the last period before a test for a review. And if she added new material, then inevitably somebody from the class would say, that's not review, that's new. That can't be on the test. You're only allowed to review. And usually that was a pretty compelling argument. She accepted that. So he had a problem. That's exactly the problem the Ramban has. So Ramban says, V'od Yosef b'sefer zakama mitzvah shelo niskru klal. Yes, it's true. There's all this new material. Can't deny it. Kigon hayibum, motzi shemra, gerishin, edim zomimin. All these different cases. So the Ramban says, well, still review. You mean still review? Still review? It's the first time. He says, well, kvar nemru lo kulan b'sinai o b'ol moed, b'shana harishona kodem amragam ki b'arvos moaf lo nischad shulo ela divrei habris kasher nisparish bo. So Ramban says something which is not in and of itself controversial, but we could still ask a number of questions about it. He says, well, obviously Moshe Rabbeinu got all of the halacha at Har Sinai. That everybody agrees to, that he got the whole corpus of Jewish law there. Now, again, you know, it doesn't mean that he got the whole Gemara. What it means is that he got, you know, all the mitzvos that are eternal in their nature and the means of deriving them from Sukkim. Okay. But be that as it may, the Ramban is saying is that Moshe got everything earlier. He's still speaking about it for the first time. So the Ramban is going to have to justify, well, if it's true Moshe got this 40 years ago, why is it coming up for the first time now?
That's a new group of people.
What's that? Okay, great. That would have been perfect. So in a counterfactual, we would say the following. And this would have worked out perfectly, and then probably everybody would interpret Mishnah Torah this way. You know what it is? Moshe held off on saying everything that's relevant to the land of Israel until it was relevant, until the 40th year. Everything else, everything that was needed for the desert, he should have said right away. That's a great theory. The problem is it doesn't withstand scrutiny, because when you start looking at Sefer Dvarim, the new material seems to have nothing to do with the land of Israel. Yibum, marriage and divorce law, Motzi Shemra, and these things have nothing to do with the land of Israel. And the Ramban himself is sensitive to that. Yes, Susan?
Well, it's a new group of people, actually. The first group of people died off, so these are a new group of people.
So then why not review everything?
Well, because these are the laws they were going to have to live by in their day-to-day, the laws of marriage, the laws of divorce, the laws of this, the laws of that. Mm-hmm. All those things were things that, and maybe in the desert, there were no people to affect this part of their life.
Right, so those are the complicated issues, because you would think that marriage and divorce law should be equally relevant in the desert. Why is it now coming up for the first time? That's essentially the problem the Ramban has to face. It's kind of difficult that these things weren't relevant in the desert. Presumably they were getting married and divorced then too.
Were they?
No, I don't think
but
so.
But then...
Do you think they went for 40 years without a...
No, I don't think that.
I think the conditions were different. It was like the conditions were havdol after the Holocaust.
Right.
With these...
It's very interesting.
I mean, really, it was a whole different
This
world.
Was the only group of people that you had for the...
Okay, so what Arthur is suggesting is actually, it seems very radical, but the Ramban himself does toy with that. So watch what the Ramban says. He says, Aval lo nichtavu ha-mitzvos b'svarim harishonim. So why aren't all these really basic mitzvos recorded in Bereishis Shmos Vayikra Bamidbar? They really should be somewhere before, especially if I'm taking the position that they were transmitted before. They're transmitted at the beginning of the Jewish desert experience 40 years prior. So what Arthur said is actually something Ramban toys with. He says, "Shidamim Yotzei Mitzrayim ki ulai lo nagu ba'osan mitzvos rak ba'aretz." Maybe they first started keeping marriage, divorce, yibum. Now, in the Abravanel, Rabbanel comments on this. He finds it scandalous. How could it be? But the Ramban suggesting it is that maybe during the desert they... I mean, we have no evidence of this being the case. This Ramban is really quite radical, but this is what Arthur was saying as well, and the Abravanel doesn't like it at all. Not that the Ramban owns the Abravanel and nickel, but the point is that you would expect to find some kind of primary text which says, oh, by the way, these things only came into effect upon entrance to the land of Israel. Like, one thing that we know this to be true for is shechita, okay, at least according to certain views, is that when the Jewish people wanted to eat meat in the desert, assuming that it wasn't a korban, they could just kill the animal. They weren't allowed to eat it while it was alive. But that once you came to the land of Israel, then shechita became the way of accessing meat. Point is, we have a lot of primary sources about that. So you would think if this is true, there's got to be some... And that's a major claim, which would revolutionize the way that we understand the Jewish people's 40 years in the desert, right? Dramatically. It's very different. There is evidence, I mean, that they didn't keep everything. For example, well, the first thing they do in Sefer Yoshua once they cross the Jordan River is? Right, they circumcise themselves. So then you start to wonder, like, what else weren't they doing? But in any event, it's a pretty radical idea. Then the Ramban sort of backs off of it, and he says, "O mipnei she'enan tediros lo hiskir rak bebanim no chalei haaretz," or because they weren't all that common, so he said he'll wait 40 years. The problem is, marriage wasn't that common. It's like a regular part of, you know, is a regular part of life. So I don't know, you know. The Ramban's in a hard place, and he knows he's in a hard place because he's basically taking the position here that Mishneh Torah again means it's a review, it's a recapitulation. Why is not everything being reviewed? Because the Kohanim don't need a review. Why is there new material? Because not really new. It was from 40 years ago. So why is it being said here for the first time? It's being said here for the first time because either it wasn't relevant in the desert, which is a big chiddush, or because it was relevant but it wasn't all that common. And we're not talking about things which are inherently related to agriculture, which you could explain, oh, this is just because, you know, they're going into the land of Israel. So the Ramban is caught betwixt and between, but he's still operating within the premise that it's Mishneh Torah. Now, just one step further, and then take Alan's question. Then the Ramban actually relates to Rashi's approach. And the Ramban, this is really the nicest piece in the introduction. Up until now, it's very complicated, but the Ramban says the following beautiful thing. Again, Rashi said, you want to know what Sefer Dvarim is about? Divrei Tochacha. It doesn't have to be a complete review. It shouldn't be a complete review. The whole thing is just designed schematically to offer the Jewish people Tochacha, a way of deterring them from deviating from the Torah. Okay, it's obviously only partially successful at best. The Jewish people, of course, in short order, do abandon the Torah. Certainly by the end of Yehoshua's life, the Jewish people were moving in that direction. But anyway, it was an attempt. Says the Ramban, so the first portion of the Sefer, before Moshe starts getting into the mitzvos, okay, the Biur HaTorah, before Moshe gets to that, he gave them Tochacha. Kama yamruhu b'midbar v'kama shiisnagim mem HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'minas rachamim zelo diya chasadav imahem ve'od sheyuchachu b'dvarv sheliyachzir l'kukulam pen yisafu b'chol chatosam ulechazek liban b'hodiyosam ki b'minas rachamim yisnaheg imam le'olam shelo yomar adam lenuchal reshes ta'aretz ki'en adam asher lo yechta umiyat yamidas hadin mitucha kenegdenu v'novad l'chein hodiyah Moshe Rabbeinu ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu rachman malei rachamim kaslicha memechila mimenu yisbarach, etc., etc. So the Ramban has this beautiful idea. He says, you know, Tochacha always has a dual component in the Torah. Number one, of course, it's meant to deter people from deviating. But even more importantly, there's a psychological point that was being made here. The Ramban says, you know, the Jewish people, nobody wanted to say it out loud, but everybody was thinking it. The Jewish people at the moment when they were on the cusp of entry of the land of Israel, they basically thought that the whole thing was lost before it started. Not because they didn't believe in God. By this point, they believed in God, but they didn't believe in themselves. And they had one very basic problem. They said, who are we kidding? We all relate to this. Who are we kidding? Right, we've got 1,000,001 rules. Go in the land of Israel. It's going to be good for a week. We're going to start to mess things up. It's all over. It's just a big mistake. we all relate to that, number one. Number two, that's a legitimate concern. That's a much more legitimate concern than the Meraglim's issue, right? That God wouldn't be able to do it. This we could all relate to. That sounds to me like really valid. What are they supposed to say? That they're going to promise to be absolutely perfect? Ki ein adam asher tzadik baretz asher lo yachta, right? The pasuk in Koheles. People have limitations. They're no perfect. So that's what the Ramban says this whole thing was about. Is Moshe's pointing out, you're afraid that you're going to sin and it's going to be all over and that you'll be kicked out of the land and, you know, God's going to be sitting there. Imagine that God sits there with his, like, dashboard, his celestial dashboard, and he's got a lightning button, you know, like, and he's just waiting, looking down, peering over the windshield, and as soon as he sees somebody, he, you know, triggers Zapper, and the digital age doesn't even have to click on it directly. He could just, you know, whatever.
It's pre-programmed.
He just has to, it's on voice command, Zap. Button lights up, it goes. So Moshe says, that's not the way it works, and I can prove it to you. Remember how the Jewish people messed up there? You're still here. Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem lifnei Hashem Elokeich. You know, you're still here. So, divrei tochacha, yes, there's an aspect of creating that kind of a deterrence, but then there's a whole additional component of trying to instill a measure of confidence in the people that this is not a brittle system. You know, you're going to mess up once and God is going to eject you from the land. This is a relationship. There are standards, there's accountability, there are expectations, but there's also, you know, a sense of flexibility in as much as, you know, if you mess up, that's all part of being human. I think both individually and communally we can relate to this point a lot. But that's the Ramban's addition to Rashi's sense of Eile Hadvarim Divrei Tochachos. Ramban says it's not just Tochachos, but it's also a sense of reassurance. Of course, even as beautiful as this Pshat is, and I like it very much, it's also subject to critique, because what can the people say? They say, well, yeah, the people messed up before, but they're kind of not around, right? What happened to the previous generation? They're like, you know, not here. So, in any event, how much of a consolation? It's only a partial consolation, because ultimately that threat of punishment and ejection is still very relevant. Of course, the Ramban will respond, well, yeah, but that's the idea, is that you're meant to balance these two things. Eventually, the Dor HaMidbar did really get stuck in the Midbar, but there were many steps on the way there. It didn't happen overnight. So, yes, you will be ejected from the land if you're really, you know, terrible over a certain period of time. But the point is, don't think that it's going to be one and done. That's really the Ramban's perspective, which, of course, is very relevant. Now, the Abravanel has a totally different reading of Sefer Dvarim. Not Mishneh Torah in the sense of a total review, not Divrei Tochachos. And he bases it on a pasuk, really the fifth pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, Ho'il Moshe be'er et HaTorah Zot Lemor. Ho'il means lahatchil, to start. So that Moshe was Miva'er the Torah in Sefer Dvarim. What does it mean that he was Miva'er? It does not mean that he repeated the whole Torah. Mishneh Torah, not in the sense of repetition, but a teaching of the Torah. So take a look at the Abravanel. He says as follows. Hu shelo haisa kavanas adonenu Moshe b'sefer hazeh lo uchiyach. Moshe's intent was not to remonstrate. That's not what he was interested in. Aval shahaisa kavanas o bilvad levo'er es haTorah v'hamitzvos osam shahayu tzrichos biur. He wanted to explain those parts of the Torah that really required explanation. I'll return to that in a moment. Ukemosha amar hoil Moshe be'eres haTorah zos kiza bilvad hayatachliso lo davar acher. V'amanti shelo ba b'sefer hazeh shum mitzvah she'atein techapsena kekesef lo timta osam b'svarim arishonim im bebiur v'im beremez v'kitzer. So Abravanel says as follows. You know what the project was here? It wasn't tochach, it wasn't anything else, it wasn't a comprehensive review. What it was is Moshe explaining certain things that had not been explained fully before. So Moshe devoted the last 5 weeks of his life to an elaboration of points of halachic murkiness. That's what it means. Ho'il Moshe Be'er. Be'er means to explain. Biur. To explain. To elucidate. Anything that had come up before but still required further clarification. So the Abravanel giveth, but he also taketh. Because at one plane, this really helps explain a lot, you know, why not everything is in here. For their Abravanel, certainly not everything has to be in here. Anything that was explained comprehensively before was explained before. But you still have a number of questions. Number one is, like, why were things said the first time but not fully explained? Why are they only being fully explained now? That's a serious problem. And also, the Abravanel has limited himself because he says these are just further explanations of things that are found before. So what's really problematic? How can there be any new material? So the Abravanel is also stuck with that issue. And that's why he says here, V'hemanti, and I believe, Shelo ba b'sefer hazeh shum mitzvah, if you really search it out, you'll find some kind of remez, at the very least, some form of an allusion to this teaching. That's tough. You really have to look deeply. So the Abravanel, how well it works out in terms of the details, is certainly subject to, you know, a question, or if not a question, at least a raised eyebrow. Point is that he adds, the Abravanel is really adding a very interesting view along the spectrum of what is Sefer Dvarim. It's Ho'il Moshe Be'er as HaTorah HaZos Le'mor. It's a biur. It's not a Mishnah. It's not a recapitulation. It's not a review. It's an elaboration on points of halachic ambiguity. Yeah, Alan.
I guess, and you could say, and he would say, the fact that you think something is new just shows you need the explanation.
Oof.
It's really not so new.
So now I just wanted to like take a step back, just throw in like my own two cents for a second. What emerges from the Abravanel, which is I think very meaningful to me, but it's a take it or leave it. So if the Abravanel is in part or in full correct, then Moshe devoted the last 5 weeks of his life not to I don't know, Mahjong, not there's anything wrong with that. I just, the reason on my mind is yesterday I had, basically through a family member of mine, I encountered somebody who's like a professional Mahjong player. So she was telling me all about, you know, her Mahjong. So anyway, Moshe did not spend the last 5 weeks of his life doing that. What he really devoted himself the last 5 weeks of his life to is halachic clarification, halachic exposition. Very nice, but when you really think about it, then it becomes very, very nice. Why? If you put yourself in the mind of the people in that generation, it's totally reasonable for them to have thought, it wouldn't have been accurate, but it would have been understandable, let's say, for them to have thought, you know, Moshe is the one who really brought us the Torah. That's true, and, you know, as long as Moshe was around, this is kind of the way things worked. But, you know, Moshe's going to be gone, so things change. So Moshe devoted the last, this is the teacher par excellence here, Moshe devoted the last five weeks of his life towards the eternality of the Torah, towards demonstrating that, you know, what we went through at Har Sinai really was irreversible, irrevocable. That wasn't a given, at least psychologically, experientially, from people's point of view. And that you see here Moshe, and the kind of heroism to me is that what Moshe is really saying is, if you think that I'm that important, meaning that not only did I give the Torah, but my passing, you know, it will fall away, this isn't about me. This transcends me. This is much, much, much bigger than me. This will be around long after I'm gone. There's a kind of heroism in that, and a sense of self, and a sense of Moshe just trying to communicate that Yish Moshe Anav Mod Mikola Adam Asher Al Pnei Adamah, that Moshe's last act is Ho'il Moshe Be'eres HaTorah Zos Le'mor, says if you're thinking, you know, that this is not going to be relevant to you, think again. You know, I'm not going to be around, but, you know, I'm not the end all and be all. I'm just here now, and when I won't be here, the halacha marches on, and the most important thing that I can do is devote myself to clarifying that which may be unclear. Now, this is all in theory. In practice, at least the rabbinic tradition, is that Moshe's death caused such a state of mourning amongst the Jewish people that they forgot 3,000 halachos. But what's beautiful is that the attempt that Moshe had to demonstrate that the content of the Torah transcends any particular individual, including himself. So just to conclude where we began, we start off with the question then, given that this is really all Moshe's review, that's Tosfos' perspective, right? Chozer al Mashakas of Lamala. Mishnah Torah Chozer al Mashakas of Lamala. That was Tosfos' perspective. And then we encountered Rashi's Divrei Tochachos, and we spoke about the Ramban's development of Divrei Tochachos, that it's Divrei Tochachos, but it's also meant to reassure. And the Ramban's view that, okay, this really is Mishnah Torah, and it's a review in the sense that everything was communicated 40 years before, so why is it only being brought up now? Because maybe they only started to practice now. And even if they started to practice it before, it was kind of rare, whatever he meant by that. And then you have the Abravanel's view that Mishnah Torah has nothing to do with repetition, but it actually means is a teaching of the Torah. Ho'il Moshe Be'er is a Torah, so similar. It's a clarification. So given that, according to Rashi, Ramban, Abravanel, each in their own, Tosfos, each in their own way, this is Moshe's contribution, then it's really surprising it should be in the Torah. That's really strange, because it's Moshe's speech and Moshe's contribution. So the Abravanel addresses this issue head on in the last paragraph, and then we'll just take a moment to reflect on it. So the Abravanel says, Ha'amnam inyan sefer azev amitasu shemoshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom amar hadvarim ha'ele ubir ha-mitzvah shenizkru poli Yisrael l'tzorech predaso. So Moshe Rabbeinu really did give this speech. This was the last 5 weeks of his life. Okay, we can't take away credit for Moshe. This really was his doing. However, Ratzah Kadosh Baruch Hu Acharei Shehishlim LaMaram LiYisrael SheYichtov BeSefer HaTorah Kol Zeh Kefima SheAmru Moshe VeUlai Hosip HaMagbura TaAmim UDvarim BeZman HaKsiva HineIm Kein SheAmiras HaDvarim HaEla LiYisrael HaYami Moshe Rabbeinu Alav HaShalom LoHaisa Ksiva SheBeSefer HaTorah MiMenu. So the Abravanel has developed a real breakthrough. Says, you know what? You can't deny two things. Number one, Moshe clearly said these things. It was his. It was Beruach HaKodesh, just through his prophetic powers, but it was his, number one. Number two is that it's equated to the rest of the Torah. So how could that be? That seems like a total paradox. If it came from Moshe, then it didn't come from Hashem. It can't be in the Torah. So the Abravanel says, no. Moshe said everything, but you know what? God came down and ratified it all. Moshe spoke it, and God says, you know, I want this whole thing written up. Can I get that in writing? Can I get that in writing? And then, of course, God dictated it to him exactly the way to put it into writing. And the Abravanel says, and it's possible that here and there, God, you know, maybe did a little bit of an editing job. God wanted it put this way and not exactly that way. But the point is that it's both. It's certainly Moshe's. It's Moshe's contribution. But at the same time, by virtue of Hashem coming and saying, you know what? Your contribution is so meaningful, and it's so worthwhile, and it was so well done that I want this including in my Torah, is a beautiful thing. It speaks to both Moshe's stature, obviously, and you know the point that Moshe had reached by the end of his 120 years on this planet, in terms of what he brought to the table spiritually, that he could be in the ballpark, right? That he could say something which God said, you know, this is really worth being in the Torah, right? That's amazing. But it even, I think, more powerfully speaks to God's willingness and desire to partner with man. The idea that God opens up his four books of Torah to take on a fifth, which is Moshe's own contribution. He doesn't relegate Moshe to Nevi'im, not like it's so bad to be left into the Nevi'im. Maybe, you know, not everybody gets a safer Nevi'im either. But the idea is that there's nothing more important than this message that Hashem wants the Jewish people to participate in the process of Torah. And this is the first step in terms of the Torah coming down from Sinai and it becoming the province of man. And Moshe's own contribution is integrated into the Torah. And from that point on, Lo Bashamayim Hi, it's all of our responsibility. So the idea that Torah is opened at the end to a human being, not any human being, but Moshe Rabbeinu with his prophetic, you know, sui generis prophecy, that itself speaks to Hashem's desire to, you know, give man a very active role in the Torah. Remember, that's Judaism's, one of our greatest, most radical contributions is that we insist is that the Torah is subject to human interpretation. Now, obviously, it's our job to sort of mine the truth. But we know that if our interpretation, based on the traditions that we have and the rules of interpretation, if that conflicts with God coming down from the high heavens and saying that he thinks it's the other way, we win, because God empowered us in that way. So is there any more potent evidence of God empowering man than God's integration of Moshe's Dvarim into his Torah, with his stamp? Yeah, sure.
He's also, in a very smart way, sort of teaching the Israel that, first of all, I feel like it's in a sense like maybe a compensation to Moshe for everything that he did, and then kind of not being able
to
live the life that he's finally giving him the voice and the mouthpiece of, Aaron had the mouthpiece before, he's finally getting, his just desserts, and, he's also Hashem, it's smart of Hashem to do that, like you said, because he's showing Ben Israel that even if you do something wrong, you still, there are ways to redeem yourself, and there are ways you're going to be rewarded in a sense.
Yeah, I like both of those things very, very much. And there's no doubt that Moshe, if you'd ask Moshe, what is it that we can do for you, this would probably be his top choice, right? It wouldn't have been this is within the parameters that were given. The idea of being integrated, I would like to think that the idea of being integrated into the Torah would have been his ideal reward. Yeah, Arthur.
You started the class with the question, shouldn't the Dvarim be in Leviathan?
Yeah.
And you, in fact, answered it, because I think the five books began when God called the world into existence, and it ended, the biblical period ended with the death of Moshe.
Yeah.
And he buried him. And there was never a relationship between God and any other man that he had that when that period ended.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Arthur's really going much, much further than I did in that regard, and raising the question of the way that God interacted with the world and the Jewish people in particular, let's say, fundamentally change at the end of Sefer Dvarim? I think the answer is yes. I think that's clear. With Moshe's death and the crossing into the land of Israel, within a few days of them crossing to land of Israel, the man stops. And, I think that's very fair to say, is that there's a change in the interaction. There's still moments when you get the kind of stuff that you would expect to find the Chamisha Chamshei Torah. I'm thinking of the ninth chapter of Yoshua, where you have Shemesh B'Givon Dom V'Yareach B'Emek Ayalon, where the sun stands still. I mean, you have your moments, and, Masa Merkava, when Eliyahu HaNavi, ascends to heaven in the chariot. But generally speaking, I think it's very fair to say that there was a very strong shift, in which case that would explain, Sefer Dvarim's integration. That would explain that in a whole different way. So that's very good. Yeah, Ruth.
About the seeds of the
Shockney
of the Torah.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Absolutely. And I guess we will. I don't want to hold people too late, so we can take as many questions as you want. But people should feel free to go. Yeah. The Netziv says the following thing. The Netziv says that Mishneh Torah means Shinun HaTorah, sharpening of the Torah, and that the point that Moshe was trying to make here is that if you read Sefer Dvarim, this is the way Netziv reads it, he thinks more than anything else, it focuses on the particular mitzvah of Talmud Torah, of teaching Torah and studying the Torah. And there is a lot of emphasis, certainly throughout the Sefer, on the study of Torah, and then Siv brings a variety of different points. He says, that's what Mishneh Torah means. It means, from the language of Vishinantim, of sharpening the Torah. And that what Moshe was really doing throughout the Sefer was emphasizing just how critical it is for the Jewish people as individuals, Jewish people as a nation, to consistently be immersed in the study of Torah. And that what Sefer Dvarim is dedicated to is, it's a long speech about the value of clarification and study of the Torah. So I'll just bring a few pieces of evidence that the Netziv cites. He quotes a beautiful medrash that says that one time when Hashem spoke to Yoshua, Hashem, so to speak, interrupted Yoshua while he was reading. What was he reading? Sefer Dvarim. That Yoshua read Sefer Dvarim as a work of chizuk, sort of the first work of Musar, because that Sefer really stresses the importance of returning to the Torah and studying the Torah, number one. Number two, In the context of the king. It says that the king has a special... You know, there's a mitzvah that every Jew has to write a Torah. There's a mitzvah that the king has to write an additional Sefer Torah. B'chasav lo is Mishnah HaTorah HaZos. He has to write another Torah. So Mishnah HaTorah HaZos, it uses that expression, Mishnah Torah. It obviously, he has to write a whole Sefer Torah, but why does it focus uniquely on the Mishnah Torah and Devarim? So the point is that the king is supposed to read Sefer Devarim more than any other book, because Sefer Devarim, more than the other four, has that inspirational component to stick very closely to the Torah, to study the Torah, to value its components, etc. So the Netziv's view is that Mishnah Torah is Shinun HaTorah, is a long speech with the central thesis of devotion to the careful study of the Torah. You know, in which case, it's not just general tochacha, it's focused. Incredibly focused, tochacha, chizuk really on the words of the on the words of the Torah and on the mitzvah of Talmud Torah in particular. That's the Netziv's view. The Netziv disagrees strongly with all those like Bali Atosos and the Ramban, who say that Mishnah Torah is a recapitulation of the Torah. He says it's just not true. You don't really see that. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, great. So we'll pick it up there next week. I want to wish everybody a very...